Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe. Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Port, and this is the Dream Job Cafe. And with me today is a very good friend of mine, Patrick Leary, and he is the managing director. He's the head of trading, and it's at Loop Capital. So I've known Patrick a long time, and so I'm really excited to kind of pick his brain about like his career in finance. So Patrick, thank you so much for being here.
Larry, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to help you out and to be a part of this journey with you.
Awesome. So let's start with, what is it that you do on like a day-to-day basis, would you say?
Sure. Well, my trajectory of my career, we'll talk a little bit about that later, but from where I'm at right now, my job primarily is to interface with clients and our sales force, and in a way that is to try to generate trades and trade ideas and help clients with their trading needs and things like that. Primarily what I do is in the bond market. I trade primarily government bonds, but we also trade at the firm corporate bonds, muni bonds, mortgage-backed securities, so all kinds of different bonds and fixed income instruments. As you may be aware, listeners might be aware, bonds don't trade like on an exchange like stocks would. And so it takes actual people to make these transactions happen. Certainly there's an electronic component of it, but it's very much more still what I would call old school in that way. And so that takes people to do those jobs. So primarily what I do is work with clients to try to solve their investment needs. We trade primarily with institutional clients. And within the context of that, we also maintain inventory of our own positions. And so managing that inventory and managing the risk position of the firm is part of my job as well. So there's kind of the sales and trading part of the business, and then there's kind of the risk management part of the business as well.
Well, so there's kind of a lot to unpack there. Does Loop Capital do equity trading or
no? We do. Yeah. Okay. So Loop Capital does do equity trading. I should have clarified, not the head of the equity trading business. Equity trading is another division of our business. I'm the head of trading for the fixed income division of our business.
Gotcha. And just so people know at home, it's like, you know, that's a pretty big division, right? Between equities and bonds, fixed income, and so on and so forth. So tell me a little bit about like what this job is like. Like, is it 9 to 5? I mean, I'm guessing you have to follow market hours, and would love to hear, like, you know, outside of work, if you have time to do what you want to do with your kids, or, you know, I know you like to smoke meat in your pellet grill. So, like, how is your work-life balance, would you say?
Yeah. So being a trader, like if you're going to start as a trader, it's you're going to be very much tied to market hours. So if you live on the East Coast, that might be a little bit more convenient for normal human beings in the sense that, you know, usually the bond market opens at 8 o'clock Eastern, but people usually require you to be there a little bit earlier, maybe 7:30, and you work until the bell at 5. Lunch breaks are usually done on the desk. If you like taking an hour lunch break and going and having your free time, trading might not be for you. I maybe get out for lunch if it's a client situation. I'll get out for lunch in a situation like that, or if it happens to be a quiet day here or there, maybe I might sneak away, but I could probably count the amount of lunch breaks where I go out to lunch on one hand in a given year. And then that, you know, depending upon where you're located, it can be a little different. I happen to be in central time zone, so that means that I usually am at the office at 6 a.m. to 6:15 a.m. central time, and I'll work until about 4. So it's nice to get done a little bit earlier, but I start a little earlier. Colleagues of mine that work on the West Coast, that changes things quite a bit. A lot of them are at their desk, you know, at 4 a.m. in the morning or 4:30. They are done earlier as well, but that depends what, you know, how your body works in that regard.
Gotcha. So they almost work like a different shift almost.
It's almost like a different shift. Yeah, we're all kind of on the same market hours. And our clients don't necessarily all do that. Some that might be banks or things like that, or hedge funds and different money managers may work similar hours. And then other things like, you know, large public entities like state treasurer's offices and things like that probably don't work those same hours. And so you're kind of shifting as well to sometimes accommodate client hours.
Gotcha. So like,
Is your work pretty much done when the market closes? Like at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, you're able to kind of check out and do your
I mean,
thing?
that's a good, sometimes I would say is the best answer to that question. You do because you kind of become involved with the inventory that you own and the position, the risk position that you have. You tend to stay kind of plugged in to what's going on in the financial markets. Just like, we live in a 24-hour news feed world. The news affects markets and affects markets, globally. The bond market opens back up usually around 6 or 7 o'clock Eastern time, but that's going to be Asian hours. So bond market's trading in Asian hours, and then it's trading in London hours, and then we're rolling into New York hours. So really, the bond market is only closed for about 3 to 4 hours a day, depending upon which time we're on, different time things. So it's you could theoretically trade all day long if you wanted to, almost with very little break. But you try to unplug as best you can. There's really not a lot to do, I would say. You can't adjust your positions or do anything like that after 5 o'clock Eastern. So I tend to be kind of like, that's my time to stop, regroup. If I need to take care of something later, I might, log on or look at the markets or kind of keep my tabs on what's going on. I like to not wake up first thing in the morning and be completely surprised by what might have happened in the overnight session. But that doesn't mean I'm waking up at 2, 3 in the morning every night to check markets.
Gotcha. So, but is there like an expectation, for example, like so the market closes, maybe you get all your ducks in a row, you get organized, you're paying attention to what's going on. Is there an expectation that like your boss might text you or email you that you have to respond to like late at night, or that you might text a direct report late at night, or is that happen commonly, or is that more the exception to the rule?
Yeah, I don't we don't get a lot of that in my kind of in the sales and trading type of world. There's not a lot of that going on. I know, people that are analysts or maybe work as junior bankers or in the banking business, that tends to be a little bit more commonplace. I will say that one of the things that comes with the job, I think, to be successful is that you do end up spending a lot of time interfacing with clients outside of business hours, though. So that might involve travel. I do travel quite a bit for my work. I tend to be on the road, either visiting clients or to other locations within our company, at least probably around once a month, I would say. Sometimes certain months can be a little heavier than I might be on the road, 2 or 3 times a month for a couple day stints. Additionally, I know folks that work, say, in New York, Chicago, some of the larger metropolitan areas, tend to be out, meeting clients or, meeting with trading colleagues and things once or twice a week too sometimes. So even though, maybe the day's work is done, there's a lot of extra credit hours that get put into being a successful, person in this industry.
That's very, very good, helpful information. And remember, folks, this is like we're talking very specifically about like fixed income, bond trading, and things like that. Like when people say they want to go into finance, the analogy I like to use in these kind of situations, like the law we talked about on a previous episode, it's like there's so much. It's like its own universe. So it's like saying you want to become an athlete. Are you going to become an Olympic sprinter? Are you going to become an NFL football player? There's just so many different things, and they all have their own aptitudes that you need and their own like work-life balances and all those different things. So if you are considering finance, you got to go deeper and really take a look. So it's really helpful to hear the perspective on bond trading and sales from Patrick. How did you get into this position? Like, take me back to when you were in like high school or college. Were you good with numbers? Did you know that this field existed? Did you have your sights set on it? Like, how did this happen?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't know it existed. I mean, just like a lot of people, I knew that there was a stock market. I knew that there were stocks and
IBM.
existed, right? Yeah, right, exactly. Everybody knew about the stock market and what was that it was all about. But really, it wasn't until I got into college. I went to school when I first started in college. I thought maybe I might want to go into medicine. I always knew that I wanted to do something that was going to be kind of a highly regarded career that was successful, that I felt like had the opportunity for, large amounts of financial gain potentially. And so growing up where I grew up, it was pretty much all doctors and lawyers that made any money. If
Right.
you growing up in our time, that was the people that made money,
Yeah.
doctors and lawyers. And so I was like, well, and a lot of the people that I knew that were doctors, lawyers were respected people in our community as well. And I looked up to that, thought, well, I could do that. That seems like a good gig. So I started as a thinking I would go into medicine. And then just didn't the amounts of time in school and the classes that it required didn't appeal to me as much. And then the medical field just wasn't really my
Me
thing.
neither.
Yeah. And so then I went into law, I moved over to pre-law and I did that. I really did like that actually. I thought that that was a very interesting field. I loved constitutional law. And then I took an administrative law class and contract law and thought, wow, this is really boring. I don't know if I can do this my whole career. And I actually was on a team in college when, and one of the older guys on the team was just had graduated law school. And I remember him meeting with me because I was on, and he said, Patrick, you don't want to do this. And so then I was a little bit lost in terms of what was I going to do, because I thought, wow, this isn't. And so I happened to have a couple of the guys that were on the same team that said, hey, maybe you should just, you know, go to the business school, come over to the business school. So I transferred to the business school and started getting more involved in there. I got involved with a internally managed stock fund that we had at the university. So it was a group of kids, group of students that, you know, joined the this fund. And then they helped manage some money for the, wasn't the university's entire endowment, but they managed a portion of it. And so it was kind of real life experience with this.
Wow.
And the professor who ran it, I took a couple of introductory kind of finance classes and bond finance classes from him. And he really kind of, you know, it clicked with me. I thought, yeah, now this is it. And I remember, in fact, he told me, he said, when he first started the class, he said, I'm going to teach all you guys how the world really works. And I thought that was really like inspiring to me. I was like, wow, it's kind of like the curtain was being pulled back, right? In terms of financial literacy. And I didn't realize how much, you know, just coming out of high school, you know, I had good grades. And even the first couple of years of college, I had good grades and was doing well. And I thought I was a pretty smart kid, but man, I really didn't know anything about what was going on. And my financial literacy just wasn't that high. And so I dove right into it at that point and really sucked it up.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I worked at Morgan Stanley and in technology, and the building that we were in was in on the north side of Times Square in the 750 building on 7th Avenue. And I would walk to work in New York City and it felt like I was walking into like the heart of the world, like the circulatory system. And right. And I could not believe, and I was like kind of a liberal arts undergraduate, and I could not believe how exciting working in finance was, just because all the stuff that's happening in the world is involved, and there's just so much activity and so many people and a lot of speed and things like this. And it was just like, it was definitely the most exciting profession that I ever coded for, you know? So I really enjoyed it. So that's pretty cool. So then you go to college, that's where you get the idea. And then you get your first job. Take me through that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So actually the professor that I talked to you about, who was also kind of the guidance professor for the fund that we ran, he did a good job of helping place students with different companies around town that would help out. And so one of the companies was looking for somebody, an intern to come in and just as a junior trading intern, just to do some grunt work and Excel spreadsheet updating, things like that. And so he had recommended that I should go interview for this position. I did. It was with a local bank here, and that was a local bank based out of St. Paul. And then so I interviewed with the bank. There was a bank trust company. They managed some mutual funds as well internally, trust money. And I got the position. I worked that position for a semester until I graduated. And then when I graduated, they offered me a full-time position to come on as a junior trader. And the great thing about that position was that I got to do everything. I did everything from trading equities for them and then all different types of fixed income instruments. I learned about a variety. Now, I was kind of on the buy side of things. So right now I work for a broker-dealer, so that we call that the sell side in the industry, right? So that's primarily the broker-dealers, like your Morgan Stanley's, like you highlighted, right? So we're kind of the dealers and the backbone. And then the buy side was where I worked, was a bank. So we were an end user of financial products primarily and invested helping clients manage their money and things like that. But I had a couple of really good mentors there that taught me a lot about the markets and about different types of fixed income instruments, the different, you know, kind of subsets, whether that's government bonds or mortgage backed securities, corporate bonds, that kind of stuff. So that was a really great experience to get kind of a really well-rounded overview of what the markets look like. Because again, when I was in college, I didn't even really know that bond trading existed. Like, we knew about bonds and we knew what kind of happened. And they said, oh, it's an over-the-counter market, blah, blah, blah. Oh, okay, by the way, let's go talk about stocks some more. Let's talk about accounting. Let's talk about corporate finance. So you have to do a lot of stuff in finance in college. And then you get out and you're like, oh, wow, this whole bond market's like, you know, multi-trillion dollar market. It's huge. And nobody talks about it.
It's crazy. The well, I thought bonds were like savings bonds, like my $50 bonds that somebody got me for my birthday or something like that. I didn't know what they were really either. You know, while I have you, and since you got, can you talk a little bit about, like, you have the trading side and the sales side that you're in charge of, and like, did you do a lot of selling? Did you do mostly trading? Did you do a combination of the two? And can you talk a little bit about, like, what the sales job is? Do you call a bank and you say, like, hey, we got all these bonds, do you want to buy some? Or what is it like? What do the sales guys do?
Sure. Yeah. Well, okay. Let's try to start up, unpack a little bit what you'll start where you first, your first question.
So many questions.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah. Yeah. So let's just kind of try to keep them a little chronologically the way you asked it. So from a standpoint of kind of what I've done is, I've done a little bit of both, always with my main focus being in trading.
Okay.
But I've always felt in this industry, and I think this is probably the case in a lot of different industries and a lot of different professions, that the best traders are also think like salespeople. And the best salespeople I've ever worked with kind of think like traders. And so there's a little bit of a gray area between kind of what is being done here. And that would go well with the job that I took when I first left that bank that I told you about, and I went and worked for a small broker dealer. It's when we moved to South Florida at the time, and I took a job, and that was a sales and trading role kind of all wrapped into one. We did have some other salespeople that worked, but it was my job to trade and buy bonds and have an inventory and manage that inventory and hedge that inventory, as well as to sell the bonds. And that's how we made our money, right? So basically, where you buy it, where you sell it, that you make your markup, mark down. And if you have any gains in the hedging and things like that, then that calculates into your profits as well. And so, like I said, I've always had a foot in the trading, and the trading has been kind of the foundation of what I do. And having the ability to have some balance sheet and some inventory to work with so that you can make trades, because your clients may not always be ready at the time that the opportunity is there to do something. And so sometimes you have to make the opportunity and you have to warehouse the risk for the clients. And that's really the value that you add a lot of times as a dealer, is warehousing the risk for clients, whether those are for issuers or for clients, and being responsible for that. Going back to, you know, sales and what that entails, is that's changed a lot over the years. I can tell you that some of the salespeople that I worked with early in my career and in the industry were, you know, very focused on really client relationships. They maybe weren't even necessarily all that when it came to knowing about markets and the products they were selling, maybe, but they were just really good with people. Mm-hmm. They knew how to, you know, they were always out with people. They were always able to entertain people, and they did a really great job of making sure that clients knew that they were important to the firm and that they were important. And then it was kind of the trader's jobs to have the products that would make sense for the clients. And the clients said, oh, well, I like Larry. He's my salesperson. He's a great guy. I have a good time with him, you know, takes me to the ball game and, you know, out to great dinners and does all this stuff. Yeah, I'll go to Larry's firm and buy bonds from Larry's firm because I like Larry, you know? And so it and there is still some of that happens in the industry. Certainly, you know, relationships still are very important. People like to do business with people they like and who they enjoy being around, but it's become more sophisticated in the sense that I would say salespeople that are operating in our industry now are a lot more sophisticated and knowledgeable. They tend to use a lot of different tools, whether those are technology tools to help them. Certainly electronic trading has changed some of this as well. Electronic execution has changed a lot of the way that clients choose to do business. But really, I would say that the progression has been for the salesperson to become much more sophisticated. And as I say, the lines between sales and trading are starting to get more and more blurred as time goes on, has been what I've noticed.
All right. That's great information. Okay. I want to be sensitive to your time. So let me ask you, where's this heading? Because I remember, for those of you, I mean, the primary audience of this is like college kids, Gen Z. And when I was growing up, if you wanted to buy like 100 shares of IBM or something, you called a broker and they charged you this big fat commission and that's how it worked. Now that's all, you know, if people have been dabbling and even there's like Robinhood, all these platforms, it's electronic. So how, what do you see in terms of the future, you know, bond trading, bond sales, and I'm talking like maybe 5 years, because I think beyond that, it's science fiction anyhow. Is AI going to impact it? Like, where is the, are there going to be a lot of opportunities there? What do you see in the crystal ball?
Yeah, so I would say that I think what we're going to see is a continuation of what we've already seen, which is a further commoditization and electronification of the trading system and the ecosystem as a whole. It used to be that, you know, treasury notes, say, for example, were traded in, you know, quarter point in increments, and now we're down to decimal places. It's becoming a lot more sophisticated, and the ability for the use of algorithms and other trading programs to be programmatically trading and trading markets is going to only increase. And certainly with, as you brought up AI, which I'll dive into a little bit later, is going to have an effect on our industry without a doubt. It's especially some of the more rudimentary tasks that we do as traders will be able to be automated through AI or augmented in some way, shape, or form. But where we're going is hard to say for sure, because there's so many other financial products that start to cross over. You know, for example, cryptocurrencies, right? You know, the stable coins that are coming out and stable coining of treasury bills and the crossover that you're starting to see now with cryptocurrency and bonds, right? And how that kind of all is starting to melt.
Oh my.
How that looks 5 years from now. Like you said, it's a little bit of science fiction. Who knows where that goes? But, you know, we've seen, say, for example, corporate bond trading, which used to be a very lucrative business for a lot of, you know, broker dealers, and used to be one of those kind of like opaque markets for clients where they didn't really know how a bond should price and where should it trade and all this stuff. And, you know, certain platforms have now come up to serve this product, and it's become extremely electronic. And it's now one of these products where it's so commoditized that having, you know, dedicated, sophisticated sales and trading staff is really not even necessary or very profitable anymore. What we've seen is a continuation of bespoke products become the focus of the dealer community specifically. These would be products where it's not as easy to commoditize it, right? Where there's something unique or special about the product. And because there's so much debt issuance, we just had another record year of corporate debt issuance. You know, the treasury and mortgages and all these, they just keep issuing more and more debt. So the debt pile keeps growing. So there's certainly business that's going to be done. But the reality is that there's probably going to need to be less bodies going forward. And the people that we need in those positions are going to demand a different skill set. And when I say demand a different skill set, I mean probably a skill set that still includes, you know, a foundation in trading or in finance in some way, shape, or form, that has a sales acumen to it, that's able to talk to people and be able to communicate with people. And then the third would be a a strong knowledge and working use of technology, specifically with AI or programming language. And those three skill sets are what it takes, I think, to be someone that's going to be successful in this industry going forward.
That's awesome, because I was about to ask you that. So basically some sales acumen, some people skills, some technology sophistication, and also kind of a foundation in finance or, you know, to be able to go into this field. Sounds really interesting. Is there a certain level of temperament that you need to get? Like, if I'm looking in the mirror and I'm being honest with myself, who should like say to themselves, this is not for me?
Yeah, that's a good, you know, that's a good question. Because I've interviewed many different people and I've worked with a lot of different people. And I can say that if you're not a person who likes risk, you probably shouldn't get into this. You know, if it keeps you up at night, you know, to take risks in any way, shape, or form, it's probably not for you. Now, that being said, if you're a degenerate gambler, it's probably also not for you, because that's going to probably not end very well. but if you don't mind some risk in your life, and you don't mind the way that is, the way the world works in that regard, it's not a big deal. Let's see what else. I would say people that, you know, maybe word on is coming to my head is, you know, don't have a thick skin, but I would say just it takes a little bit of kind of, you have to be humble in the sense that you know you're going to be wrong sometimes. Like, you know, you make your best educated guesses and you put trades on and you put strategies on that you think are going to work. And sometimes you're just mighty humbled and you're just like, okay, that just didn't work out. And you can't beat yourself out about it. You just got to move on, right? Like you say, hey, you know, I move on, next trade mentality. In a same way like an athlete would, right? Like right. You have a bad game or, you know, you throw an interception as a quarterback. Like that stuff's going to happen. So you got to be able to bounce back quickly. And that's a big skill in this industry to be able to do that.
It's like the Ted Lasso goldfish thing. All right. Well, this is great. And I guess my last question would be like for people, and you had a great piece of advice, which I always tell people, which is get involved with clubs and get involved with your professors. But any advice for people who are curious about this and might want to go down this path? How would you approach a career search? Any advice there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing I would recommend is just going back to that, like get involved at your university. I know a lot of universities have similar programs to the one that I was involved in when I was younger. If there's other programs you can get involved with, reach out to other, you know, industries, professionals and things like that and network, you know, do a good job networking with people. Sometimes it's hard for folks that are kind of at my level and doing what I'm doing to really network a lot with people that are in college, because that can be a little bit of, it's just a lot, right? It's a big pond and there's just a lot of minnows swimming around in that pond. So you're trying to figure out who to network with and what kind of makes sense. But I would say, you know, applying for internships, a lot of, you know, our company has a big intern program, probably, you know, for like this summer where I think we do it pretty early. So they're probably already getting set for that. But, you know, most, like your big Wall Street firms are all going to have intern programs and things like that you get involved in. And even those smaller, you know, companies, you know, insurance companies, banks, anything that's involved in the industry in some way, shape or form, asset managers, things like that are going to all have intern programs and intern opportunities. Those are the best ways, because most companies, when they hire an intern, they're making an investment in you the same way that kind of you're getting invested in them, right? And if it works out, they're going to want an employee to come on board, right? I mean, that would be my thing. My biggest complaint a lot of times about having interns in this industry has always been, well, we give them all this information and we teach them and teach them, and then they go. And you're like, okay, I didn't get any return on that, unless you have a project maybe you had them work on that gave you a little something. But sometimes you put a lot in, you don't get anything back. So you get one that really works out and you're like, yeah, I want that person to stick around and I want them to be here in the future. So I would say using an intern program is huge in this industry. And then additionally, I would say, you know, as we talked a little bit about AI, we didn't get really too in the weeds, but it's just, I think that one of the things that young people, especially if you are interested in AI and different large language models and how they work, and you're good at prompting and you're good at using them, continue to develop and hone those skills and use that as a calling card. Because a lot of the folks in the industry, like myself, we're not that good at that. This is all very new to us. Yeah, we might be good with Excel. And yeah, we understand a lot of the technology we've used for most of our career. But programming and using, you know, large language models to help program and help write code is just not something that our brains do very well right now. And so if you can help bring that to the table for somebody that might be, or a team or a firm that might be wanting to do these things, but not really sure how to make it happen, you can really be a piece of that. And I think that can be a calling card for a lot of young people right now to find spots.
All right, Patrick. Patrick Leary, thank you so much. This was excellent. So again, give us a good rating if you want, if you liked what you heard on our podcast, and tune into future episodes of Dream Job Cafe. And if you can, be grateful for something today.